This is the Criminal Law Revision Commission, Subcommittee Number 3, March 27, 1970, 1:30 p.m., Room 315, Capitol Building. Today's subject, offenses involving firearms and deadly weapons, preliminary draft number 1, firearms control, preliminary draft number 1.
In accordance with the peculiar habits of the legislature, I'll bang the gavel.
Peculiar?
Ludicrous is the word you're searching for.
Ooh, don't put that...
Okay, Don.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think a good place to start today on our discussion of firearms control and our draft on firearms and dangerous weapons generally would be to read into the minutes an extract that was taken from the commission minutes, which summarized the directive that the commission gave to the staff and to the subcommittee with respect to the question of gun control. And this is from the meeting last week. Judge Burns moved that the staff and subcommittee number 3 be directed to prepare a draft which would call for licensing and registration of all handguns. The licensing was to refer to the licensing of the individual and registration to the gun. The system would authorize the average citizen to have a gun, but would prevent certain classes of individuals from obtaining a license. The article should contain some provision for review of licensing decisions by the courts. The motion carried following discussion. Senator Uteri asked how long the barrel of the gun could be and still qualify as a handgun. Mr. Knight read the present definition of a handgun from ORS, which said the barrel was 12 inches or less. The commission was generally agreed that a definition of handgun should be contained in the firearms article. Chairman Uteri asked if the article should contain provisions for a person who had a gun license to loan that gun to one who was not licensed. It appeared to be the consensus that this situation would be analogous to loaning a car to one who had no driver's license. Therefore, the one borrowing the gun should probably be licensed also. Mr. Chandler suggested that the subcommittee and staff be directed to provide in the article that the fees for licensing and registration would be sufficient to pay the cost of administering the program, which should not be so large as to deter people from applying for registration or licensing. Mr. Chandler moved that anyone who owns or possesses a gun must have a license for any gun. Motion carried. Summary of the discussion was that the registration would apply to concealable weapons or handguns only, and licensing would apply to all persons who own a gun of any kind. And this is has been the staff's understanding of our task was given to us by the commission, and I think for the record I should advise the chair also that earlier this week, I contacted the state police office and talked with Superintendent Holcomb. Told him that we were going to be discussing this question today and advised him of the date and time of the meeting. And he indicated that we would have a representative here for the meeting. Presumably, someone will be here. I think Captain Howard was planning to sit in on it, in as much as the State Police Department is going to be certainly affected not only by a central registration procedure, but even without that, if we attempted to change the procedure for licensing individuals to carry concealable weapons, to centralize that in the State Police Office, I felt it would be well to have somebody here to sit in on that discussion also. Now, by way of a little background on what the staff did this week, Mr. Chairman, Roger and I examined what we felt were probably the two states that are generally considered to have the most stringent gun control and probably what comes closest to being model legislation in this area. That's New Jersey and Massachusetts. New Jersey, I think, is probably the one that's cited most often, although as we got into it, we came to the conclusion that Massachusetts is probably a stricter gun control state than New Jersey. But we examined those statutes and examined the provisions of the Omnibus Crime Control Act 1968. We also studied House Bill 1546, which was introduced in the last session of the legislature, which was the bill that the Kennedy Action Corps recommended as an example of model legislation that the state could use to have effective gun control. Now, we have a draft in your books that appears in the last orange tab, and I certainly don't have any pride of authorship in this, because we've attempted really to comply with the directives of the commission, although I'm sure we all recognize that this could be done in a number of different ways. And there are a number of approaches that can be taken to this area and still fall within the broad outline that was given to us. And the question is, I think one of the basic questions that we have to decide is, assuming that you want a gun registration or gun licensing law, whether it's going to be what's known as a permissive type of statute or a restrictive type of statute. Now, of course, the permissive type of statute provides that an individual, if you're talking about handguns, cannot have a permit for a handgun if he falls within a certain type of category of persons, or a certain classification of persons that you try to establish in the statute. But otherwise, he is entitled, if he complies with the requirements and applies for the permit, to be issued a permit. In other words, the burden is on the state, in effect, to issue the permit unless there's good reason not to. Whereas the restrictive type is that, and it's most often used with respect to handguns, is that there isn't going to be a permit issued unless the individual can show good cause why he should have one. Now, the draft that you have before you is in the nature of a permissive approach with respect to handguns, the registration of handguns, and with respect also to the licensing of the individual to own or possess any gun. That is, that the individual would be issued these permits or licenses unless there was a good reason not to issue them. I've tried to draw no distinction between the requirements for the handgun and the requirements for any other firearm, except insofar as the information that the applicant must furnish at the time of his application for either a permit or a license. You require two additional pieces of material or information from the individual with respect to handguns that are not required under this draft for long guns, rifles or shotguns, and that is, number one, the individual's fingerprints, and number two, a full description and identification of the handgun involved. Now, the approach that I've taken here in this draft embodies a number of sections that appeared in House Bill 1546, but it expands considerably on a number of particulars, and I suppose that we ought to just start through the draft and see what it does.
John, before doing that, would it be possible for you to give a brief rundown on existing Oregon law as far as licensing and as far as possession of concealable firearms?
Well, of course, existing law, there isn't any with respect to any kind of restriction on ownership of handguns or long guns either. The only place where we have some controls is, number one, on the sale, at the point of sale, certain firearms, in which a dealer is required to maintain a register and submit certain information to the state. And secondly, with respect to permit to carry a concealable weapon. And the way the statute handles that now, this is handled on a local level and can provide...
Carry a concealed weapon.
Carry a concealed weapon, right. And there is no centralized... control over it, the chief of police or the local sheriff makes this determination. And
well, we have a prohibited group, of course, as an ex-felon.
Right.
And we have also an educational program required before a hunting license is issued to a person who's 18 years or younger, the hunter's safety certificate, all of which I think fall within the area of gun control.
Yeah, true. I'd agree to that, sure.
Don't forget aliens.
An alien. White foreigner. The federal law requires reporting on sale of ammunition as well as guns, am I correct? Have you checked through the federal gun control?
It does, yes.
Because to buy a lousy box of shotgun shells these days takes 10 minutes of identification and writing
the
registry.
Let me qualify that. The original 1968 bill did. I believe recently, within the last 90 days, that section has been repealed by Congress. Now, when that repeal goes into effect, I don't know. But I've been told that buying ammunition now does not require the same information that it did after 1968.
Yeah, Roger, do you have a copy of that new statute that the legislature passed last time? Have you got that?
Mm-hmm.
That was to tie in with the federal law. Now would be a good time maybe to mention that too. I think I am. Maybe I do.
I gave it to you.
There's a new statute, ORS 166.490, which was passed by the last legislature, which deals with the purchase of firearms in certain contiguous states. And that means California, Idaho, Nevada, or Washington. And it provides that a resident of this state may purchase or otherwise obtain a rifle or shotgun in a contiguous state and receive in this state or transport into this state such rifle or shotgun unless the purchase or transfer violates the law of this state, the state in which the purchase or transfer is made, or the United States. This section does not apply to the purchase, receipt, or transportation of rifles and shotguns by federally licensed firearms manufacturers, importers, dealers, or collectors. This section expires and stands repealed upon the date that Section 922B3 of the Gun Control Act of 1968, 18 U.S. Code 922B3, and regulations pursuant thereto are repealed or rescinded. And this was the only new bit of legislation regarding firearms.
There was one other piece, and that prohibited the use of firearms in certain areas of Deschutes County, the Bend area, which was tied into an existing statute applicable to the Devil's Lake area.
Yeah, and that, of course, there's another kind of a specialized statute that really isn't a form of gun control.
That's not reflected in our draft. Prohibition against discharging firearms within a specified geographical area.
Yeah, right. And then, of course, there are a number of other sort of statutes, such as pointing a firearm at another and things like this, that all of which I think are picked up and discussed in our basic draft that had prepared before we got into this gun control area.
Well, we also have a number of enhanced penalties for ex-felons who are using a gun, and some of them extremely strict as far as the enhanced penalty provision of the statute.
Well, there's that statute that if they allege and prove that certain felonies were committed with the use of a firearm, which was not, for which he didn't have a permit, that you can enhance the penalty and not put them on probation and all that sort of.
We have a, yes, that's right, there's a particular statute which prohibits probation, isn't there, for, sorry, specified crimes committed with the use of a firearm. Now, there's also,
it's very seldom, actually, that the DAs allege that, but occasionally they do.
Do they do it? Okay, allege that he was armed with a concealable weapon without having a permit for it.
Yeah. I had a case recently where they did that, and they, there wasn't any evidence that he had a permit. He never claimed he had it. As a matter of fact, he denied he was the holdup man. And the jury didn't find him guilty of the enhanced section. I don't know how.
They found him guilty of the armed robbery, but not
but
the
not having a gun without a permit. So I guess somebody must have told him about the statute.
We have a provision now, too, for ex-con in possession, which prohibits the court from suspending in possession of sentence or allowing probation. We also have a statute that prohibits the possession of various types of firearms, machine guns, I've forgotten the exact wording of it, but there are a number of them.
I just got a call that I've got a couple of witnesses I have to run over to my office and interview, and my primary interest is when you get into the concealed weapons and offenses involving weapons part of this thing. I have written a memorandum that I think is fairly self-explanatory, Don, and we recently at our office had to issue an opinion on whether the tear gas pencil or the incapacitating type of thing that a woman would carry in her purse should be included within the concealed weapons statute. And I think partly the problems that arose in that opinion can be taken care of on redrafting by simply excluding the incapacitating type of devices as opposed to the weapons which are traditionally thought of as causing affirmative, aggressive types of injuries from the concealed weapons statute. And if you could, Don, just read my memorandum into the record when you get to that point in case I can't get back. I do think the committee ought to kick those ideas around. If I'm here myself, I'll
good.
Go ahead.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I suppose we ought to start through and plow through it, shouldn't we?
I'd rather not, but Dave's certainly right. I mean, we've got all kinds of controls on firearms now, of one sort or another, in the statute, but of course nothing that goes to...
How did you vote last week?
Nay,
and I will continue. Might be a good time to state my policy dealing with the matter, and that is I am not going to vote in subcommittee or in full commission meeting to either increase the existing penalties for possession or increase the existing type of weapon to be possessed or to have into our to put into our law and graft upon it provision prohibiting any further than already is prohibited the possession of any kind of a firearm, whether it be long or short. Particularly, I am opposed to whether it be permissive or restrictive registration of any kind of a firearm, other than those firearms which are not normally used for either sporting or hunting. And in that group, I would put machine guns, bazookas, anti-tank guns, and the wonderful list we were furnished by former member of this committee who is not present today. Shot off shotguns, you're right, it's in the statute. So any draft we approve in subcommittee is going to be 2-1.
Dave, can we confine that you've made your intention?
My diatribe, I think that's
clear. Now you've made your pitch, settle down and help me write the legislation.
can you approach our this afternoon with the idea that if we were going to have these things, the type you would prefer? Recognizing that you are opposed to everything.
If we're going to have sin, let us have you draw a graphic description of the type of sin you prefer.
Only if I can partake. No, as a matter of fact, you aren't. I feel really very, very strongly about this, and I have subverted my ideals often enough and long enough and prostituted my beliefs, and this one I'm not going to budge.
Compromised, Your Honor.
Well, assuming that it existed in the first place. Failure consideration.
Well.
No, I really do. I feel very strongly about this. I've talked to a number of people since then, and they're not nuts. They're not NRA
if it exists, and by the way, the Kennedy Action Corps told us that this bill had been defeated because of the National Rifle Association. I know of no one connected with the National Rifle Association that's ever been in my two terms of the legislature. I don't, as far as I know, they don't exist.
Well, I tried to contact somebody from the National Rifle Association when we were setting up the appearance before the commission so we get the other views. And I couldn't find anybody.
Well, there is no lobby.
The guy that was here was from the National Rifle.
No.
Salem attorney.
But he was representing another gun association in Oregon, but it wasn't the NRA. There is, and then there's another, this other group. There is a group, this Right to Bear Arms
Association. For the Right to Keep and Bear Arms in Medford. They're a nut group.
And I've had some indirect contact about them, not from them, but about them this last week, and I made it known that if they had some written materials they wanted to submit, they were free to do so, but we had taken already heard testimony on both sides.
Well, as I was mentioning, I've talked to a number of people.
We had to go out and find somebody,
though. Yeah. And I don't put these people in the classification. These are lawyers in Hillsboro, Oregon, businessmen and so on, who are not necessarily hunters or fishermen or anything else, or outdoorsmen. But to them, the idea of requiring registration of any type of a gun is repugnant. Now, if I could see on one hand an extremely convincing argument as to why registration of firearms of any type would be quite effective, I could be persuaded. But the Kennedy Action Corps presentation is nothing more than a pure philippic with one objective only. And given a little bit of time, I'm sure we can find statistics that would shoot down every statistic they put up. It's written from a biased standpoint for a purpose. I quite frankly don't think that Oregon's ready for it, and as a peripheral idea, I think if we include, and this is my same pitch I made to the commission, but if we include that type of thing in this draft, we're asking for destruction of 4 years of work by this committee. It is, the feeling is that strong.
I expressed my views along these lines at an earlier subcommittee meeting, but now I suppose, Mr. Chairman, we've got some other materials. If you want to get into some of these other things before you get to the draft.
Why don't we go through the draft? But
we tried to this week dig out as much information to lay before you as we could that you didn't have access to already about what some of these other states are doing and whatnot. And Roger has a real interesting Duke Law Journal article here. I'm not sure that we understand what it says, but we might want to talk about that later. Okay, well, with in mind what we've said about what the commission told us we ought to do here, Section 1 sets up some definitions that we use, and probably the critical definitions in there, under Sub 3, firearm, that definition is essentially the same as the definition that appeared in House Bill 1546, except that I've inserted the words handgun, rifle, shotgun in there, because handgun and long gun, I suppose I could have used just long gun rather than rifle or shotgun, but firearm then would apply to any kind of a gun.
Let me ask you this. Do 4 and 6 exhaust the category?
Well,
is there something between 4 and 6? Other than 5, of course.
Well,
in other words, would 6 include a sawed-off shotgun?
Well,
I would say probably not.
Because
a sawed-off shotgun would be illegal per se.
And we've prohibited that type of gun elsewhere in our original draft.
And defined it.
I mean,
that would put the in the same classification as a machine gun or an anti-tank gun or this type of thing. It'd be a firearm.
But in other words, under sub 3, if the guy owns a firearm, that maybe it might be some type of legal, because it's not prohibited elsewhere in our firearms draft, it might be a legal type of gun, but he's still going to have to comply with this, even though it might not be a shotgun or a rifle or a handgun. because of the broad definition of firearm, I think we should have the basis covered there. But
you're including also a BB gun. Expansion of gas or air pressure.
Well,
air is a gas. And there are some extremely lethal weapons. Which
there are, and you know, there's the cylinder type of
BB gun. But this definition is used in a lot of the recent legislation, and I don't think any of them contemplate inclusion of a BB gun, although they do contemplate inclusion of these. There is a type of gun intermediate between a BB gun and a rifle. What are they called? And they do use a gas
cylinder
type of cartridge.
But I would think that to expel or hurl a projectile by the action of explosion or expansion of gas. Air is, I think, by definition, a gas, isn't it?
Well, maybe it is. Now, I wasn't thinking of air itself as being a gas, but that might be something we wanted to check out, because
What the devil does a BB gun work with?
Compressed air.
Yeah, you
compressed air.
As you pump into a chamber, compression of air.
But you do, but I did, I did have in mind, and I assume that whoever used this original definition, and I think this is the same definition that appears in the New Jersey law, on their definition of firearm, that, and I took it to mean the kind of an air pistol that would use the bottled cylinder, you know, or the but not just air as pumped into the chamber by a lever action or something like that. But if air is a gas, and
well, Webster defines air as the invisible, odorless, and tasteless mixture of gases which surrounds the earth.
Wonderful.
So, gas.
Well, it has to be either gas or solid or liquid. Chemically.
Yeah. Well, now
it ain't liquid, it ain't solid.
Well, what we better do is take care of that by putting
commentary.
Either that or, well, we could. I don't know whether you want to say except for a BB gun or not, because then you're. You may be opening up another can of worms, because some BB guns could be pretty powerful if they do use a bottled gas.
Well, the pump type BB guns, if you use the larger shot, could be a lethal weapon.
They are, and there are guns designed that the more you pump them, the more compressed air you have, and by the time you work it over, it could be an extremely lethal weapon.
You'd have to say, except BB guns.
The Red Rider variety.
Yeah, except for Daisy.
For the Daisy or Red Rider.
I would point out, this is the type of ludicrous problem we're going to have all the way through this ludicrous section.
You'll see. Well, I'm thinking we struggle with
you'll
this.
You'll be sure and bring them all out.
I'll try to point them out as best I can.
Well, do you want to go on, or should we stop here?
Let's go on.
But that's a problem.
We've identified the problem areas with Dave's help.
All right, then we've defined handgun as a pistol, revolver, or other firearm having a barrel less than 12 inches in length. Now, here's where we get into the...
I've got a question on the 12 inches in length. Is this a... I mean, that's what the present statute says, of course, which was enacted back in 1853.
Yeah.
Is the 12 inches a common length for pistols? That do they make, say, 14-inch barrels on pistols that would not come under the definition of a rifle?
Well, I don't know, Frank. Whether there's a cutoff there at a specific number of inches, but now Massachusetts uses a definition that says less than 16 inches or 18 inches in the case of a shotgun. So they've gone all the way up to 18 if it's a sawed-off shotgun or something like that.
But of all the laws I read, only Massachusetts varies from 12 inches. And I think 12 inches is based upon the concealability of the weapon rather than the type of weapons that are made.
Yeah, this is something that they consider anything 12 inches or less can be concealed. And that's where the definition of the...
Right. Well, I thought about using a definition that didn't put any inches in there and just say capable of being concealed upon the person, but then you get into kind of never-never land, it seems to me, that how is a guy going to know whether he's required to register that thing or not? I mean, that's kind of a value judgment, whether it's capable of being concealed.
That's what I was asking. I mean, whether or not if we have a thing like this, they could start then putting out 13-inch, well, this, we say less than 12-inch, put 12-inch barrels on pistols and have them the same as rifles, I mean, as far as coming within any
to evade
prohibition, to just evade registration, when really, in effect, they're a pistol.
Well... Well, that's the problem, they have to handle it. It appeared that there was a whole bunch of 12-inch guns being manufactured.
You can put it in the commentary.
Well, you know, it doesn't seem to me to be too likely that unless this kind of legislation became so widespread that gun manufacturers felt they had to try to overcome it.
Is there any, I don't know a dang thing about guns. But, I mean, there isn't any such thing now as a 14-inch barrel on a pistol. That's a pretty long barrel, isn't it? But the old cowboy 45s probably had that long a barrel, didn't he?
Well, you know, that's a foot long. If you've got a pistol with a barrel more than a foot long,
that's the barrel itself, not the chamber, which is another business.
Right. That's just the barrel. I mean, that's going to be a long one.
I think 12 inches. Abuse it, why we can always take care of it.
Okay, then sub 5 is a term called an identification card, which means a firearms purchase identification card issued under section 5 of this article. Long gun means a rifle or a shotgun, and permit means a handgun purchase permit issued under Section 5 of this article. So as far as the licensing and registration, I've tried to approach it from the standpoint of an ID card. That's a term that's used in some of these other statutes, although not necessarily in the same way we've used it here. And then the permit would be, in effect, the registration vehicle for picking up the description and serial number, etc., on any handgun. Now, I have followed the rationale of the House Bill 1546 in approaching this as a purchase permit. Although, in effect, because of one of the sections in here, we're going to pick up people who already have guns. Because we say you're going to have to comply with this, even though you already have the gun. But the main idea is to get to it through the purchase. And it's maybe a little bit of a misnomer to call it a purchase permit, although it certainly does that, but it goes far beyond that. But I was trying to stay away from a word like license, if I could. talk in terms of purchase. Okay, then we go on to Section 2, which provides, except as provided in Section 4, in Section 14 rather, and that excludes certain individuals like members of the armed forces and police officers and others who, because of their duties and whatnot, have to...
Members of the legislature from Washington County.
And former members.
And former members.
Okay, so except for Section 14, no person shall A, purchase or otherwise acquire a long gun or ammunition, therefore, unless he first obtain an identification card, or sell or otherwise transfer a long gun or ammunition, therefore, to any other person unless the other person possesses a valid identification card. And subsection 2 would just be your penalty section. The idea here is to identify the individual rather than the gun. But the individual who wants to purchase is going to have to in effect, get the purchase permit or the ID card as provided later on in the article.
Is there a reason why you say valid identification card in B and not in A?
Yeah. About as long as you have an identification card, whether it's good or not, you can purchase.
But as long as you, in 5, you talk about an identification card shall be valid permanently unless revoked or suspended, and it seems to me that if you leave out valid in sub A, somebody might well conclude that you can purchase it with an invalid identification card, although maybe you had some other thing in mind.
Well, I did, but I can see that there might be some confusion there. Because there I was directing it at the purchaser and requiring him to obtain an identification card,
which
presumably would be, if he obtained it, it would be valid.
Couldn't you say unless he first obtains or, obtains or possesses.
What is your identification card? That's not your permit to purchase.
Yeah, it's a permit to purchase. It's a firearms purchase identification card. That's to purchase any firearm. It's really to purchase a long gun, because if he's going to do the other, he has to then get the handgun purchase permit.
Don, in concept, will this prohibit mail order sales originating in Oregon to a out-of-state resident?
We discussed
interstate commerce. I would think that maybe the state of Oregon doesn't have too much control over.
Well, that's controlled to some extent now by federal law under the 1968.
What effect would this, if adopted, have upon that?
It wasn't intended, Dave, to prohibit or interfere with the sale or mailing out from Oregon as far as trying to control it by Oregon law if it's a resident of some other state. But
about the mailing in to an Oregon resident of the gun ordered from the state?
Well, of course, the mailing in. The individual who receives it, of course, is going to have to comply. I don't know how we would get to the seller from some other state. We can't get to him, I don't think. But we can control it, because once the person acquires the gun, whether he's bought it in the state or outside the state, then he falls within the requirements of this draft. He's going to have to.
So it's not a right to purchase, it's a right to possess.
Now we're getting to it.
Call it purchased.
Well, yeah, that's what he calls it, but it's not. It's the license to own the gun.
And we'll put it in the commentary. We'll take care
of it. No, I don't want to put it in the commentary. I just didn't want to say anything about it, really.
This is why I got the question here. It says, you say no person shall purchase or otherwise acquire or sell or otherwise transfer. Now, does this, is it intended to cover like what Bob Chandler brought up as far as say I don't have a shotgun, so Dave talks me into going hunting with him, and so I go down and get a hunting license, and then he loans me one of his 3 or 4 shotguns to go hunting with it. Now, I haven't purchased it, but does otherwise acquire mean to obtain by borrowing, and sell or otherwise transfer, does that cover loaning? It seems to me that it probably could be interpreted to mean that, but yet when you say purchase, or otherwise acquire. It seemed like that would mean gaining it by a gift or something to where you own it. Or sell means that, or otherwise transfer means would be some way transferring ownership.
What you're saying, you're talking about title or you're talking about possession?
Yeah. So is it, do you have to have the permit to possess or to own?
What do you do in a situation, a not uncommon provision in the will is for the man to leave his hunting and fishing equipment to his son?
We've provided for that.
You've done that, huh?
We have done that.
The executor can make a transfer without requiring the...
Eventually, it's going to have to be picked up, but we do give him a period of grace here in which to... I think it's under 14 I've picked that up, too. Yeah, I've got, notwithstanding sections 2 to 4 of this article, a permit or identification card shall not be required for the transfer of a firearm upon the death of the owner. However, the person who receives the firearm shall obtain a permit or identification card or dispose of the firearm within 180 days after the day he receives the firearm.
Sort of a 180-day estate in the firearm. It's like a life estate in a bottle of brandy.
Yeah.
But is this...
Well, it means possession, doesn't it? It doesn't mean just ownership.
If this is what we want, is possession, I think that, I mean, or otherwise acquire, I suppose it's stealing it would get you into the more permanent type of possession.
You can say otherwise acquire possession.
Well, isn't the whole premise of this approach to prevent certain people in your categories from not having the right to have a firearm? In other words, they can't obtain it.
That's certainly one of the major objectives, as I understand.
If that's the case, it was seen that you could not loan a firearm to a person that didn't have an identification card.
That's right.
Like you couldn't loan your pistol to one of your clients.
Yeah, I got a pistol, too, about a week ago. Part of a fee.
Yeah.
He was reduced from assault with a dangerous weapon to a simple assault.
But it seems like if we should say purchase, but you should say possess in
Well, it seems to me
that's what you mean. So
if there's any doubt in the meaning, we should say otherwise acquire possession of.
Yeah, well, I knew I was going to have trouble on that.
This seems to imply, without saying it, this seems to imply an ownership type of situation rather than a possession.
Well, of course, this is this is around the barn approach that was used in House Bill 1546.
Yeah, well, let's not go too far around the barn.
You know, because there, I mean, they talk about purchasing, too, but...
When they say purchase or otherwise obtain.
Yeah, and I just used acquire because I thought it was a better word.
But then they say to pick up the people that presently have them, they say owns or possesses.
Yeah, but well, I've taken care of that too. I have a section on that. I have a section, section 4, which does the same thing. In fact, I've gone beyond that because I've picked up the person who moves into the state, which they don't. Mm-hmm. And I've given him a period of 90 days to comply before we jump on.
Well, what disarray would be caused if we inserted the word possession?
Well, that's fine, Mr. Chairman. No, and that's...
Mr. Follett moves that we insert the word after acquire or possess. Section 2.
I thought acquire was a good term. And see, I'm looking at the well-being of the whole code again. And
I can understand.
That's why I wanted to leave that word out of this particular section. But
I can understand what you're trying to do, Don, but if we mean possess, I mean, it can very rarely... strongly argued under this language that we don't mean simple possession, we mean ownership.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
so
I think we
mean possession,
let's say so.
Say so. I so move.
You want to, that would read otherwise acquire possession?
Yeah, I mean that the word possession be used in there.
Oh.
or otherwise acquire possession of. And the same thing in B.
Well, it'd be sell or otherwise transfer a loan.
Transfer possession of.
Yeah, or otherwise transfer possession.
Well.
Well, I know I wouldn't get one if I were that.
Any further discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Carried.
Better put invalid then if you're going to do that, huh? In front of identification.
If you record this, you would want to have invalid there. Okay.
Any objection if we insert?
No objection.
A valid identification in A.
Clean corpse.
Okay, section 3.
All right, for a word in section 2, I'd suggest maybe farce.
For a what?
Well, never mind.
All right, and section
3. Try to fill in the blanks.
Section 3, pretty much the same as section 2, except here we're talking about a handgun or ammunition for a handgun, and an identification card, rather than...
Better put in here again, possession and valid identification card.
Here you need both. You need the identification card and the permit, both.
We need to throw in the term, or otherwise acquire possession.
Yeah, we could make this conform.
Yeah, we should conform 3. To 2, so that it reads purchase or otherwise acquire possession of unless he first obtains a valid identification card and a valid permit, and then similarly in sub B. And I assume the vote is the same on that.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Might as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. All right. I imagine you're going to want to come back to all these, but just to give you an overview of the draft. Section 4, this is very similar to Section 4 in House Bill 1546, except as provided in Section 14 of this article, a person who owns or possesses a firearm on the effective date of this article shall, within 180 days thereafter, sell or otherwise dispose of the firearm, or obtain an identification card if the firearm is a long gun, or obtain both an identification card and a permit if it is a handgun. And then 2 is new that I've inserted that was not in 1546. And this is to pick up persons moving into the state. Person moving into the state shall, within 90 days after becoming domiciled in the state, sell or otherwise dispose of any firearm he owns or possesses, or obtain a permit or identification card as required under subsection 1 of this section.
I would think that probably like radar control and building permit requirements that we should be required to post at the borders of the state a notification to all persons entering that within 90 days they must dispose of or acquire a permit or license.
Yeah.
Well, if it's good for radar, it'll be good for...
Well, I just wonder if you have something here that... What about the fellow that passes through? Can he own or possess a firearm?
Yes.
If he can do his contract in less than 90 days, he's all right.
I would think so. I mean, I don't know how you're going to... we talked about this a lot this last week, and trying to come up with some way to control that kind of individual, and... I don't.
Generally, that kind of a guy can very well be one of the most dangerous guys.
But he's not.
Well, like the armed robber,
he's not the kind of guy that's going to come forward and register
in California.
Good point, Don.
That's what's wrong with this whole thing. You see, the guy that you really want to get to isn't going to comply with anything.
Well, you also drive up the cost of firearms on the black market, which is good for black market firearms dealers.
Well, how many crimes are committed by people with stolen weapons in the first place? The ex-con can't get his gun unless he gets one at a fence or steals it.
FDWD hit the case I had was involved a stolen weapon. Where's the next guy?
Same you took point. It as your fee.
But we'll have this
court appointment.
We'll have this advantage though, Dave, if we adopt this approach. If it's a stolen weapon that was stolen in this state and that weapon had been registered, then we'll be able to tell where it was stolen.
In other words, he can break his contract for misrepresentation that it was not a registered weapon.
This isn't as hypothetical as it sounds, though. We get quite a few letters. I just answered one recently over at our office from people who are going on vacation in the state. For instance, a deputy sheriff from Los Angeles County wrote me and asked, you know, I carry it mounted in a holster on my dash. Am I okay in driving through your state on vacation this summer? So that problem does come up more often than you'd think.
Oh, yeah.
Quite a few people who camp out, for instance, take guns with them for either recreation while they're camping, that kind of thing. The elk hunters, for instance, are deer hunters who come into the state.
Of course, in terms, sub 1 is not restricted to residents, is it?
Well, not in so many words, no.
There isn't a penalty section here, is there?
You know, it would seem to me that...
No, because I thought that if they don't comply with this, you'll pick them up under the other section.
If I may revert to theory for a moment, it seems to me that the framers of the present code weren't so terribly wrong when they applied the sanction at the commission or after the commission of a crime as opposed to trying to legislate goodness and sweetness and light prior to the commission of crime. We're talking about 99.9% of the population who may possess or use a firearm of some kind, or no problem. If criminal sanctions are a deterrent, then why are people who use them otherwise? What are people going to do it anyway?
Well,
maybe.
So much for theory, though.
Well, I might mention that most of the recent studies made aren't concerned only in the area of crimes involving weapons. They're also concerned with accidental shootings and suicides. Accidental shootings probably would not be affected by gun control. Suicides probably would, assuming that some of these people had a background of mental instability.
Well, we haven't quite gotten to that yet, but that's another problem, I think, as far
didn't stop Dr. Johnson.
But I think it's pie in the sky to think you're going to stop suicides by requiring firearms registration. I mean, it just... There are just too many available methods of killing
oneself.
Oh,
you're not going to stop
suicides.
You're just going to reduce suicides by
firearms yeah.
And increase them by other means.
Oh, you won't touch it. Any idiot can get his hands on a gun these days within 2 hours if you want one badly enough. You can sign an affidavit so I promise not to commit suicide with this gun that I'm purchasing from you with my valid ID card. It's going to help a lot. It's a breach of contract case. We'll have to pay for the gun.
Well, on sub 4, should we not again put in valid? Of course, I'm not sure that really if we define the permit section correctly, we can throw out all those valid.
Yeah, that's maybe
we can do that when we get
that. May be a thought that we could go back and modify permit or the ID card and the permit both.
Well, we're coming to this section, aren't we?
We're getting into the paperwork part of it.
Does the committee intend to make an exception for the out-of-state visiting hunter, that kind of thing, bring his gun into the state?
If he visits for less than 90 days?
Well, impliedly we've said this because we say that a person moving into the state after he becomes domiciled,
90 days in which to
get his deer.
So if he's not moving into the state, he's not going to become domiciled, he wouldn't have to comply. At least this was my thinking. Now, whether this really lays that out clear enough.
Yeah, what about Judge Burns' comment, though, on the problem of that fellow simply being subsumed into the Category 1?
What about the...
In other words, if it doesn't accept him, does it include him?
Well, sub 1 really means a person domiciled in this state who owns or possesses a firearm. That would be
intent. This is to take care of those that are in the state, own the guns, effective day of the act. What about the student who spends 9 months of the year in Eugene Corral's world? He's not...
He's a resident, but he's not domiciled.
He's not domiciled.
That's right.
When you use the term domicile...
Well, these are tough questions. I'm not sure I can answer them, Frank. Most of them we thought about this week.
How about the others? What are the other states?
But you start talking about residents, and it seems to me you're making it too broad, because a man can have a residence in the state and hell not even live here, in practical matter.
What do the other states do on this?
Very little.
it's hard to... they use terms like no person. New Jersey uses the same approach, no person shall do this. And I don't think there's any... the only exception under the New Jersey chapter about persons outside the state is with respect to carrying concealed weapons. They do try to draw some distinctions there. And but otherwise, as near as I can determine, both New Jersey and Massachusetts don't, in so many words, exclude non-residents. But you get the impression from reading their statutes that you're intending to cover people who live in the state, you know.
Well, I might...
They leave the non-residents to the discretion.
Something. Unless these states have passed companion legislation, as Oregon has last year, and it's not reflected in this material. The firearms cannot be sold to non-residents in these states under the federal law.
Right.
Yeah, like it can't be sold, but I mean, that doesn't solve your problem of somebody coming in here with a weapon in his possession.
No.
A non-resident coming through on vacation or a student, you know, any number of types of people. But we can certainly try to spell it out more clearly if that's what you want to do. I mean, if you want to say we're talking about a resident or we're talking about a person who's domiciled in the state or both, or we can certainly do that. It seemed to me that the people, that from the standpoint of the state of Oregon, that these aren't the people that we're primarily concerned with in the first place, and secondly, I'm not sure you can control it. Because it's going to be just a chance that you're going to pick these people up anyway, in violation of the statute. Mere chance, anyway. But, I frankly don't know the answer to just how to get to that kind of problem. And whether these other states went through the same kind of process or not, I don't know. They don't seem to deal with the problem in their statutes.
Well, let me ask you this. Suppose we passed this, and I had a rifle, and I just didn't do a thing with it. Sat there, and 180 days passed, and that was it. Now, would I be guilty of a crime?
Yeah. You'd be possessing a firearm without an identification card.
The Fifth Amendment problem there is that after the 180 days had passed, you couldn't be required then to apply for an identification card.
You're subject on that 180th day.
Because, yeah, then you're in violation and you go in and register, and if it's picked up and that you've gone beyond this time, assuming that there will be some way to determine that you would be incriminating yourself. No question about it. And of course, this is the big area where it is in a state of flux as far as the constitutional question, not the Second Amendment question that is raising havoc with these statutes. It's the Fifth Amendment problem. And the very kind of people you want to get at most may have an out under the Fifth, because of they're the nature of individual who are going to be incriminated by compliance with your registration requirements.
Yeah, there's an article in this Duke Law Review, which is a very recent thing, on the cases are holding exactly that on these people within prohibited categories, they cannot be prosecuted under federal or state law for failing to register guns or to apply for the firearms license. This is no way to prosecute.
You can't
expect an ex-convict to take his gun down.
In fact, in Chicago, they have a Chicago ordinance on gun control, and they specifically say every person except ex-convicts and so-and-so and so-and-so. And they exclude the kind of people who would be incriminated. So you get the ludicrous situation of saying, well, this statute doesn't cover you because you're a crook, and you're gonna be excluded because otherwise we're going to have this thrown out on a constitutional problem.
Well, an ex-felon would have to have the long gun.
But that was pointed out. This is the one area that the staff report on this President's Commission on the Causes and Prevention of Violence discussed.